Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm asking, will the new definitions of first world and third world be those countries that have the virus under control and those countries that don't? Connor Gibson with Greenpeace USA is here about three states making protesting fossil fuel pipelines a felony. Is protesting becoming illegal now? Robert Weissman with Public Citizen drops by. He's concerned about Trump's land management pick. The guy's a climate-denying extremist. I'm concerned, too. Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear is telling us about even more nuclear waste that they want to bury under New Mexico's desert. Plus, geeky science. Does sitting cause cancer? This morning on CNN, there was a physician, I believe he was an emergency room doc down in Texas, and he said yesterday was one of the worst days of his life because 10 young people with COVID-19 presented at the hospital, all so seriously ill that they needed immediate hospitalization, and he only had three beds. He had to decide which seven were going to not get treatment and which three were going to get the treatment. Trump's response to this coronavirus pandemic has killed over 100,000 Americans and has thrown this country into a multi-level disaster, a medical disaster, an economic disaster, a political disaster, and for Americans all across the country, a personal disaster. Meanwhile, the European Union, 440 million some odd people, I mean, all of Europe is around 800, I believe, million, but you know, this is just the EU. Just those countries that make up the European Union, 400 and roughly 40 million people, larger than the United States, had 3,000 and change new cases. Arizona had over 4,000 new cases. Florida had over 10,000 new cases. The United States had over 50,000 new cases. What's happening here, and it's happening right in front of our eyes, it's just astonishing to me that there's virtually no discussion of this in corporate media, is that the world is bifurcating. And maybe there's no discussion about it because it really gives the lie to the whole mythology of American exceptionalism. The world is splitting into two groups. Now, the world has long been split into two groups, and we have historically said those groups are, on the one hand, democracies that are wealthy, the United States, Europe, countries around the world, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, countries around the world that have used democracy to build, a strong social safety net and a functioning government and a relatively happy populace and a vibrant economy. And on the one hand, and then on the other hand, countries that were either communist dictatorships like the former Soviet Union or Vietnam, or China for that matter, although they're now falling into this first category, or countries that were just very poor. So it was basically, and the communist dictatorships were also very poor. So it was basically the rich countries, the poor countries. That was, which was kind of also democracies versus autocratic governments. That was the old bifurcation. That was the way the world was. Well, now the new bifurcation, the new split in the fork, is those countries that have COVID under control and those countries that don't. Just that simple. And in those countries that do have COVID under control, they're going back to normal. And the countries that, albeit with small changes, people wearing face masks, splitting schools into smaller classrooms, things like that, but not in America. Here in America, we're crashing. Vice President Biden gave a speech in which he was basically saying to Trump, "Why don't you stand up and lead?" Well, Trump doesn't know how to lead. He's never led in his life. but he was put into place by a group of right-wing billionaires, and all of them not in the United States exclusively. Right-wing billionaires in Russia, in Israel, in Saudi Arabia, right-wing billionaires in the United States. They put Trump into power, and if their goal, if they hired him specifically to destroy this country and to weaken American democracy or weaken democracy around the world so that their power and wealth would increase, then they spent their money really well putting Trump into office. Republicans like Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, they're laughing at the idea of democracy. Even during the last 4 years of the Obama presidency, McConnell was laughing at the idea of the democracy. Oh, the Constitution says that the president gets to appoint a Supreme Court justice? Well, not if he's black, not if he's a Democrat. Ain't gonna happen. That was Mitch McConnell. And Donald Trump, I mean, they are laughing, they're spitting in the face of the idea of democracy, while the American working class lays shattered on the ground. Can America and democracy recover? And if so, how long will it take, and where should we begin to rebuild our country? Or do the right-wing billionaires intend to continue their war against democracy and the American working class? And if so, what does that mean? Donald Trump said the coronavirus is just going to disappear. Right? It's just going to go away. I hope. Hope is not a strategy. Hope is a campaign slogan, right? Hope and change, but it's not a strategy. A strategy, you do things. Down in South America, the world is bifurcating, splitting into countries that do have coronavirus under control and those that don't. Uruguay has had fewer than 100 active cases at any point during the last month. The country next door, which is much larger, but still, the country next door, Brazil, has 1.3 million active cases. They're right behind the United States. What's the difference? Uruguay did something about this early on. Ken Parks writing over at Bloomberg News, on Monday, Uruguay became one of the first countries in the Americas to return to most classroom learning. Public events like theater performances are also set to open soon. President Luis Lacalle Pou was faster to act than his regional peers, moving to close borders and issuing a voluntary lockdown less than a month after taking office on March 1st. Brazil has never issued lockdowns. Uruguayans also enjoy a robust safety net thanks to generous spending on health care, pensions, and social programs during the previous 15 years under left-wing governments. Uruguay is ranked number 2 in South America for social spending, 17% of GDP. It also has one of the lowest poverty rates in the Americas, 8.8%. It's typically around 30% in the rest of Latin America. In Uruguay, the use of face masks has been mandatory since March. School classes are frequently half their pre-COVID size as students rotate between school and online. All of this done so that they can have a relatively normal life. And it's working. The Caribbean opened to international travelers yesterday. The Bahamas and Jamaica, they've got this thing under control. The border between Spain and Portugal was reopened. Remember I said all of the European Union had fewer than 4,000 cases yesterday? New cases. In the Netherlands, sex workers can go back to work. Legal prostitution. In Belgium, many public spaces were allowed to reopen yesterday, including pools, amusement parks, casinos, indoor playgrounds, and theaters. Masks are necessary. Everybody gets tested. They have contact tracing. They're doing it right. Connor Gibson is on the line with us. He's a research specialist with Greenpeace USA. Greenpeace.org/USA is the website. You can tweet him at Climate Connor, C-O-N-N-O-R. Welcome back to the program. It's been a while. Glad to have you with us. Tell us about these three states that have decided to make protesting fossil fuel pipelines a felony. How do they pull this off?
Well, there's a playbook they've been using for a few years now. Oil companies, not just the pipeline companies, but the refinery companies, have been circulating a model bill, which was, of course, produced by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, on behalf of these companies. And the model bill is twofold. It attempts to deter people from protesting by threatening them with felony-level fines and prison sentences if they protest on what they're defining as critical infrastructure, which of course includes a number of fossil fuel assets, pipelines, oil refineries, petrochemical facilities, all sorts of things. So oil companies are enshrining themselves with special legal protections by defining some of their property as critical infrastructure. A protester who dares test that law could potentially get fined thousands of dollars for the simple act of nonviolent trespass on, say, a pipeline construction site. And they could also go to prison for many years just for doing that. The second part of the ALEC model bill not only go after individual protesters, but organizations supporting them. So if you are an organization, say a Greenpeace or, I don't know, Sierra Club or American Civil Liberties Union, and you're found to be a co-conspirator to the person who dares commit nonviolent trespass, you can be subject to 10 times the fines that the individual can. And so this is both a deterrent against protest in the first place. For the most part, these oil companies just want people not to have the gall to stand up against the oil and petrochemical industry, but they're getting revenge insurance in case somebody does. They know that they have politicians willing to put these laws on the books and prosecutors that are willing to put them to the test.
I noticed that one of the three governors, this is South Dakota, Kentucky, and what's the third state? West Virginia. One of those governors is a Democrat, Andy Beshear in Kentucky. What happened?
Well, I couldn't tell you exactly what Governor Beshear does. I know that in general, Kentucky is a coal-friendly state and fossil fuel-friendly state, and so partisan politics looks pretty different there. And it just goes to show that because a Democrat is in office doesn't mean that these laws aren't going to get. Need to look no further than Wisconsin, where it was the American Petroleum Institute last year that got the local trade unions to champion these bills, and Democrats were the ones who were pushing for them. So the law that is on the books in Wisconsin, which is one of these laws going after individual protesters with felony charges for nonviolent trespass, that was championed by Democrats. So it's not just red states that are subject to this trend. And there's a fourth state now, just in the last couple of weeks, Mississippi's governor also signed a version of these laws. And so Mississippi has now joined a total of 13 states that oil companies have tried to make it extra tough to protest. And it's just supposed to show how scared the oil companies are. And the reality is that this is a reaction to the unprecedented indigenous coalitions that we saw against the Keystone XL pipeline, TransCanada, and against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is built by Energy Transfer. And the success and the mobilization and the energy of these protests in an era where we are seeing the impacts of fossil fuels on our air, on our water, and on our climate, we know there's a better way to produce energy, and we know there's a better way to fuel our transportation system. And the oil companies have seen the writing on the wall. This is just a way to both retaliate and attempt to buy themselves a little bit more time to exist in the 21st century that increasingly needs fossil fuels.
So you mentioned ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is a group that was brought into being in large part through the efforts of petro-billionaires, the David and Charles Koch and their buddies back in the day. Is this pretty much exclusively ALEC work that's going on right now?
ALEC is just an instrument of these oil companies. So ALEC only does what it's paid to. They're not like where the ideas originate. They're just a service for the lobbyists. And the very convenient thing for an oil company is that when you pay to be an ALEC member, you literally get to sit at the table with state politicians and you vote as an equal on ALEC's model policies with those state politicians. So what we know about who was using ALEC in this case, in December 2017, there was a meeting that ALEC had where they adopted this anti-protest model legislation, the template that legislators are now passing in laws around in states around the country. There was a letter sent to ALEC at that time by a number of lobbying groups, trade associations, representing the oil refineries, representing electric utilities, representing gas utilities, as well as one company that put its name on the letter, and it was Marathon Petroleum, which is a refinery and pipeline company, a particularly aggressive one. And so after ALEC created this model bill, in a variety of states through the patchy lobbying disclosure, what we've been able to, Marathon Petroleum in particular is the tip of the spear here. A company like Koch Industries has also been particularly involved, Valero Energy, and of course TransCanada and Enbridge and ExxonMobil, some of the usual suspects. It's an unholy alliance that also extends beyond just the oil and gas sector. They've brought petrochemical and plastics companies into this coalition. They've brought electric utilities into this coalition, and even some untraditional allies, like I mentioned, some local trade unions in certain states like Wisconsin and Illinois, water utilities, right. Basically anybody they can to help broaden the coalition to advance the oil industry's effort.
So what are the next states that are in their bullseye they're targeting?
Well, they put their eyes on states like Illinois and Ohio and Pennsylvania for several years for different reasons. There are different companies with different projects in those states, as well as different extraction opportunities, shale in Pennsylvania, for instance. And these are all states where, so far, successfully, coalitions have been able to fight those laws off. There's a coalition of folks on the ground in Ohio that have worked valiantly to show up at every legislative testimony opportunity, speak out against the bill, organize against it, help circulate word in the press. And I commend those folks. They've done a great job in fighting these bills. Similar with Illinois, there was a half-hearted effort this year, but last year in 2019, there was a concerted that looked very much like what we saw in Wisconsin, where the oil industry was trying to put local trade unions as the face of this effort.
Presumably be the unions that represent the pipe fitters, you know, the guys who are going to be actually building the pipelines?
Yes, which is, you know, a subset of the broader, you know, very large community of unions. Compared to nurses and more progressive unions, the trade unions have traditionally been more conservative. And in this case, they've been willing to take the talking points of the American Petroleum Institute and be the front of that. But they did not succeed in Illinois, and I hope that they will not succeed in Illinois. But again, this is all a reaction to how much resistance the oil industry has faced from a growing number of people and coalitions all across the world. They know that the era of fossil fuels is coming to an end. In fact, the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed how weak some of these companies are. They're going bankrupt. So it's just an effort to buy a bit more time.
Keep up the great work, Connor. Really appreciate it. Connor Gibson with Greenpeace USA, greenpeace.org/USA. You can tweet him at Climate Connor. Connor, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
On the line with us is Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste specialist at beyondnuclear.org. Their Twitter handle is also beyondnuclear, as makes sense. Kevin, welcome back to the program. Nuclear waste being buried in New Mexico? Tell me about this.
Oh, we've got a big fight on our hand. It would be the world's largest high-level radioactive waste dump. It's a company called Holtec International. It's teamed up with some local pro-nukers called the Eddie Lee Energy Alliance, and they want to so-called temporarily store 173,000 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel in southeastern New Mexico. That's twice what exists in the United States right now.
Whoa. So would they be bringing radioactive waste from all over the country? I mean, what is that quantity of nuclear waste relative to all the, I know most nuclear power plants around the country have been storing waste for decades on site in these pools. How much total is out there versus how much they want to put in New Mexico?
We're approaching 90,000 metric tons of commercial irradiated nuclear fuel, and that's what they're proposing to take out there. And also the hottest category of low-level, so-called, which is called greater than Class C, it's highly radioactive. And our expert witnesses had to wonder, with such a big number that they're seeking a permit for, are they talking about foreign waste as well? Are they talking about U.S. military waste? So a lot of unanswered questions from a very shady company.
Why do you call the company shady?
Well, they have a bad habit of engaging in bribery, for one thing. I worked with a couple whistleblowers for the past couple decades. One of them has since passed, and they had the dirt on the quality assurance violations with these Holtec high-level radioactive waste containers. And the company CEO tried to bribe them into silence. They did not take the bribe and continued to blow the whistle. But he and the company were convicted or involved in a conviction of bribery down in Alabama at the Browns Ferry Nuclear Power Plant, and then lied about it later to get a $260 million tax break in New Jersey. And they're in pretty serious hot water up there for that one.
So this nuclear waste facility that they're trying to build in New Mexico, is there a good chance that this will happen? And if so, how are they going to entomb this nuclear waste? Or are they going to try things like reprocessing it like the French do?
Yeah, reprocessing is very much on their to-do list. We have taken this case to the second highest court in the land, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, as has a grassroots national environmental coalition. We're soon to be joined by the Sierra Club. We even have an oil company as an ally because this dump threatens their oil and gas business out there. So the fight is on. There's a big July 9th public comment session by webinar and call-in. We're going to try to turn as many people out as we can. And the plan is just subgrade. It's these pits. They would drill 10,000 pits and lower these canisters down into it. And the truth is, this would probably be permanent because we don't have a repository. And that's actually Beyond Nuclear's legal case. They can't do this. It's illegal. The Department of Energy cannot take title, take ownership, take liability for these wastes unless there's a repository open in the country. And even DOE has admitted that can't happen until mid-century. So it's illegal what they're proposing. And the NRC has just been complicit in this illegal proposal.
So basically, they just want to dig holes or drill holes in the ground and dump barrels of radioactive waste in those holes. What might that do to the water supply? Isn't most of New Mexico over a fairly large aquifer?
It is close to the Oglala. And actually, incredibly, there's a sibling dump in Texas. The two dumps proposed are only 39 miles apart. And that dump in Texas, called Interim Storage Partners Waste Control Specialists, is above the Oglala. So they are messing with the Oglala. The state of New Mexico has pointed out under the current administration, Michelle Lujan Grisham is governor, that yes, indeed, that New Mexico dump is threatening local water sources. And they don't like that too much because water is especially precious in a place like
South New Mexico. So New Mexico is fighting this.
Oh, yes. The current administration is. The previous Republican governor thought it was a great idea. But the current Democratic governor and her entire administration, the entire U.S. congressional delegation, which is all Democrat, are fighting it at this point.
We're talking with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste specialist with BeyondNuclear.org. Kevin, I understand that, you know, Trump, it was one of those, like, not even a one-day story. It was like a two-hour story, given the insanity of the news cycle around Trump. I'm reminded of Milton Mayer's book, you know, when he talked with Germans in 1950, and they said, we got used to being governed by surprise. Every day was a new horror in the news. But this little two-hour story was that Trump wanted to have, he wanted to bring back above-ground nuclear tests, or perhaps below-ground, but, you know, he wanted to start testing nukes again. What's the status of that? What's going on?
Yeah, it's incredible. Like you're saying, this is madness. The United States did its last full-scale nuclear weapons test in Nevada, and it was below-ground in September of 1992. So this is a very provocative proposal that they're floating. It would very likely, if it went forward, lead to renewed nuclear weapons testing by other countries. I mean, China, Russia, North Korea, India, Pakistan. Very dangerous. You know, it's not the first time that Trump and his people have hinted at this. Even before taking office, they kind of mentioned that, well, you know, maybe we should blow up some nuclear weapons in Nevada. Nevada is going to fight it tooth and nail. They already are. The congressional delegation is introducing legislation to block that funding. They've got a good chance of doing so. On the House side, they've got Pelosi's ear. They've got the appropriations chair, Nita Lowey, the subcommittee chair, Marcy Kaptur. I don't think they're going to get it through this funding for nuclear weapons testing. They're not going to get it through the House of Representatives. It's going to be blocked by the Nevada delegation.
So in order for Trump to test nuclear weapons, he needs a specific congressional appropriation of funds for that purpose. Do I understand that correctly?
Well, under normal times, but look what he's done with the border wall, for example, moving money around like it's a slush fund against congressional will. So we'll see, you know, how far it goes. If he's doing this supposedly to drive the Russians and the Chinese to the negotiating table, it's just an insane way of doing it. And if he thinks he's going to win Nevada in November doing this kind of thing, I think he's going to have a surprise.
I think he thinks it'll add to his image of tough guy. I just got the Trump coloring book, which the Trump campaign is sending out. Literally, Donald Trump is a superhero, you know, flying through the air with his fist out in front of him and looking all macho and stuff. And I mean, this is the image that his followers are constantly tweeting projections of him, you know, his face on Rocky's body and all this kind of stuff. He seems to be addicted to this weird, phony idea of masculinity, and somehow nuclear weapons testing is tied up in that. Or do you think that I'm being too psychological about this, and it's really just the weapons industry wants to do these tests and they're offering to give Republicans some money to do it or something? I mean, what's driving this?
No, I think you're really onto something. I mean, I think of phrases like the Mad King or Caligula. There's a great book called The Firecracker Boys about nuclear weapons testing in the 1950s and 60s. It focused on Teller trying to blow up hydrogen bombs in Alaska, supposedly to build a new harbor and to mine coal.
Right.
Any excuse to blow up nuclear weapons. And yes, there are those making incredible amounts of money on it all. It's a major part of the nuclear weapons complex, the military-industrial complex. And it also, you know, was our supposed ticket to superpower status. Nuclear weapons, nuclear power, we're going to tell the world what to do. They thought they'd have a monopoly, but Soviet Union caught up within 4 years.
Okay, on the line with us is the president of Public Citizen, Robert Weissman. Citizen.org is the website.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And Robert, welcome back to the program. Tell us about Donald Trump's efforts now to basically destroy our environment and our country, in this case, vis-a-vis the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, well, it dovetails what you've been talking about, sadly. He's just named to run the Bureau of Land Management, which is part of the Department of Interior and does what it sounds like. It oversees the public lands. A man named William Perry Penley. This guy goes back to the Reagan era, and he is connected with what used to be called the Wise Use Movement, which is an extreme property rights movement that believes in privatizing the public lands, has fascistic views of the role of the federal government, and is sort of built implicitly, and not so implicitly in his case, on racist views.
Wow. Did you say fascistic?
I mean, the only way that it's not fascistic is that they're so anti-government. It doesn't sort of dovetail right with the sort of centralized power view of fascism. But it is extreme stuff about the need for private power. If you recall the sort of gangs of white gun owners who've taken over public land spaces, that's his crew.
Sure.
That's the sort of universe in which he flows, and he's now the guy, potentially, who's going to be in charge of the public lands.
So what's this guy's name again, and what did he do before this?
His name is William Perry Penley. He's worked in a right-wing think tank, but he goes back to work in the Department of Interior all the way back in the Reagan administration.
Does this require approval by the Senate? Is this the sort of
it
nomination?
It does, and it's possible. He said such extreme things about the Black Lives Matter movement that he may run into trouble even in the Republican-controlled Senate.
So is Public Citizen, we're talking with Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, so are you guys calling on people to contact their members of Congress and say,
and vote this guy down? So this would be a Senate vote, and it's not up yet, but he was just named to be the permanent director of the agency. You know, he wrote, we know the political movement spawned but with the name Black Lives Matter, was built on a terrible lie.
Really?
That's our guy.
What's the lie in his world?
That Michael Brown's had his hands up.
Oh, geez. That's insane. That is insane. So, Robert, I know that you guys at Public Citizen are all over these issues in general. More broadly, we've got a fossil fuel lobbyist running the EPA and a fossil fuel lobbyist running the Department of the Interior, and the BLM is, you know, subbed to the Interior Department. What sort of damage are these guys doing in real time right now?
Well, you know, at the EPA, they basically have had a policy since the coronavirus that they're not enforcing pollution laws. Their logic is twofold. One is that polluters, because of coronavirus, don't have the staff to do compliance, to make sure they're reporting to the agency. And second, that if to get the economy going again, so-called, we need to get regulations out of the way. So in the name of dealing with a public health pandemic, we should further endanger the public health.
Did Trump do this by executive order, or is this the head of the agencies, the head of the EPA, just saying, here's the new way that we do
that? That is policy from EPA. There are other agencies that have done similar things. Trump issued an executive order that sort of talked about this but didn't have any real meaningful force of law. This is policy from the Environmental Protection Agency, and because it's an enforcement issue, you know, they're not rolling. They're doing other things to roll back rules, and we and others are suing over those. But when they just say we're not going to enforce, there's almost nothing anybody can do.
Other than getting registered to vote and making sure that you're going to get an absentee ballot and be able to vote, you know, in November without taking your life in your hands, what else can Americans do to push back on this? Or is this the, you know, do we really need a political, to paraphrase Bernie, revolution in this country, at the very least throwing Trump out of office and his buddies?
Well, both and. I mean, so of course I'm a follower and I'm with you that we do need the political revolution. And one thing I think we've seen with the Black Lives Matter approach is when people get out in the streets, things change, and they can change really fast. So of course we need that. Mm-hmm. And also we need to do things like protest the specific nomination. I mean, this is a case where the guy is so extreme, I think Republicans, especially in an election year, are going to have trouble ushering him through. So if the public weighs in and says, vote down William Perry Penley, there's a real chance that the Senate will block his nomination from moving forward.
And the number for the switchboard at Congress is 202-224-3121. And you can call and say, I'd like to speak to my senator. If you're not sure who your senators are, all of us, unless you live in D.C., have two of them. The operators there will simply tell you. You just tell them what state. And this is the Senate, not the House of Representatives. Robert, you guys are doing such great work there. I am so appreciative of what you do. Keep it up.
Please. Thanks so much, Tom. Always great to be with you.
Thank you. Good talking to you. Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen. Citizen.org is the website, at public_citizen or Rob_Weisman, WEISSMAN. So, some interesting new science that I think takes on a particular relevance and resonance now that a good chunk of America has been sitting indoors since March, coming up on 4 months. For me, it'll be 4 months on the 10th of July. I've told you before, Louise and I try to get out every day and walk for a couple of miles, and I've got a little app on my wristwatch that pings me every hour and says, get up and move around. Just literally get up and walk around the house, climb a flight of stairs, whatever. I really, on the days when we've had really crappy weather days, when I've just skipped the walk, I really notice it. It's just amazing to me how quickly our muscle tone falls apart. And so Louise and I got a couple of kind of yoga mats, and we've been doing some exercises with YouTube videos and in addition to our walks, you know. And here, Gretchen Reynolds writing for the New York Times. The headline, sitting all day may increase your risk of dying from cancer. I'll just share a couple of clips from this. Extremely sedentary people can be as much as 80% more likely to die of cancer than those who sit the least. This study indicates getting up and strolling, even if you do it slowly and only for a few additional minutes a day, might lower your risk of dying from cancer. This was a study that was done of 30,000 middle-aged and older men and women starting in 2002. That was, you know, 18 years ago. A good longitudinal study with a large group. And these people all wore a sophisticated activity tracker that carefully measured literally everything they did. The men and women in the group who had spent the most hours sitting were 82% more likely to have died from cancer during the study's follow-up period than those in the group who had sat the least. This association held true even when they controlled for age, weight, gender, health, smoking status, education, geographic location, and other factors. According to these models, for every 30 minutes that someone exercised instead of continuing to sit, the risk of later dying from cancer fell by 31%. 10 minutes a day of gentle strolling, housework, gardening, or other light intensity activities reduced the risk of dying by cancer by about 8%. 10 minutes a day. They conclude, it looks like getting up and walking around the living room for a few minutes every hour could actually make a meaningful difference in your lifespan. It's not like our bodies don't intuit this and constantly tell us this. So, important stuff to know and pay attention to. Herman Cain. This is interesting news and, I suppose kind of sad news. Herman Cain is a fellow human being, after all, regardless of what you may think of his politics. A week and a half ago, as you know, I don't do time well. Without a calendar, I'm lost. But it seems like it was 2 weeks ago. Might have been, whatever. Donald Trump held his Nuremberg rally in Tulsa. And, a couple thousand people showed up. There are some reports that as many as 1,000 of them were actors. I'm not sure I believe that, but whatever. It was a bust. Right. I mean, he wanted 18,000 people. He got six, maybe. Not to mention a lot of staffers and a lot of Republican VIPs. And all these people were yelling and shouting and screaming and hooping with no face masks. And one of the luminaries who was there, one of the VIPs in the VIP section, was Herman Cain, without a mask, surrounded by people who weren't wearing masks. So this was just posted on Herman Cain's Twitter feed, which I've been following for quite some time. In fact, I just retweeted it. On Monday, June 29th, Herman Cain was informed that he had tested positive for COVID-19. By Wednesday, July 1st, that would be yesterday, Mr. Cain had developed symptoms serious enough that he required hospitalization. He spent the past night in the hospital, and as of today, Thursday, July 2nd, he is resting comfortably in an Atlanta area hospital. Mr. Cain does not require a respirator. He is awake and alert. There's no way of knowing for sure how or where Mr. Cain contracted the coronavirus. Oh, I think I know. But we do know he is a fighter who has beaten cancer. With God's help, we are confident he'll make a quick and complete recovery and will soon resume hosting the Herman Cain Show at HermanCain.com and Herman Cain's America at Newsmax TV. Please join with us in praying for Mr. Cain and for everyone who has contracted the coronavirus as well as their families. How about praying that people wake up to the stupidity of showing up at a Trump event like thousands of people are planning on doing this weekend in South Dakota without a mask and without social distancing? Seems like that's an appropriate prayer. But, good luck, Herman. Good luck. I hope he makes it through. And I hope this experience wakes him up a little to what's going on. Maybe he'll become an evangelist for wearing masks. Who knows? That's all for this week's Science Revolution. You can find the video portions of the Science Revolution on YouTube and check out our Facebook page.